طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. The lies that Israel has told to justify their genocidal response to Hamas's October 7th attack have driven that false narrative into the mouths of President Biden and Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, and most of the mainstream media. We hear of mass rapes, beheaded and incinerated children, and other outrageous atrocities allegedly committed by Hamas during their raid. Yes, war crimes were committed by Hamas, but so many of these outrageous atrocities have not been confirmed by forensic evidence, substantive photographs, or even the production of the mutilated babies. The Electronic Intifada and The Intercept magazine, among others, in the independent media, have investigated many of these allegations, as well as Al Jazeera, and all have come to the same conclusion. The worst of the atrocities cannot be confirmed. Al Jazeera recently produced a film on their report, and this morning some of the journalists that worked on that project lay out the essence of their reported findings in a discussion that can be found on their website, as well as the hour-long film. So here is a discussion of the Al Jazeera report on their podcast.
Today, Al Jazeera investigates the events of October 7th.
Hamas and others committed very real crimes on October the 7th. The oddity was that in the days that followed, the world's media focused not on the crimes they did commit, but on crimes they did not commit.
I'm Kevin Hurton, and this is The Take.
My name is Richard Sanders. I was producer director on Al Jazeera's investigative unit's new film, October 7th, which is a film about the events of October the 7th in Israel.
So, Richard, we work together in Al Jazeera's investigative unit. Why don't we start with the essence of the documentary, and then we can drill down on some of the finer points. So what is this story about?
Okay, so it's essentially a very forensic, detailed analysis of exactly what happens on October the 7th and an analysis, really, of the way the story has been told subsequently. What we conclude is that Hamas and others who came through the fence that day were certainly guilty of human rights abuses. There is no doubt about that. But that many of the most lurid stories, the sort of stories that were repeated again and again and were used in particular to justify the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip, many of those stories were not true.
The film creates a timeline of the day of October 7th, beginning at dawn as Hamas fighters break through the fence and enter Israel. And a lot of that timeline is public knowledge at this point, but the film gives us a beat-by-beat picture of just how it unfolded. And it does this by using actual footage of the day, from CCTVs to dash cam footage to actual body cam footage from the Hamas fighters themselves. From the timeline, we see how for the entire morning of October 7th, Israel puts up almost no resistance. And I'm tempted to ask how Israel didn't see this coming, but from speaking to a former Israeli official, and as you show in the film, they did see this coming, right?
Yes, it's hubris, really. Hamas were hardly keeping it secret. You know, you can see them training in the open. In many cases, only a few hundred yards from the fence. I mean, almost everywhere in Gaza is only a few hundred yards from the fence in a way. Mm. And they were actually filming these training sessions and putting them online. The Israelis simply misread them. Their reading was that Hamas was contained. Mm. Hamas was preoccupied with running the Gaza Strip, that Hamas did not have the ambition or the capacity to actually do this. And they clearly completely underestimated them.
In the film, Chuck Frelick, a former Israeli deputy national security advisor, explains the response after word first got to the country's military intelligence and the internal security service, the Shin Bet.
In the early hours of the morning, there's already pretty good information that something is happening, to the point that the head of the Shin Bet and I think shortly after the chief of staff all arrive in their offices, 2-3 in the morning. And it is, again, it's written off probably as being just another exercise. And the decision is to come back in the morning and take a look at it again. Of course, between those hours and then the attack at 6:30 a.m. was too late.
At 6 a.m., the Hamas fighters are told to gather together at meeting points.
No one of the fighters have an idea about this operation, up to minutes before the operation.
This is Bassem Naim, a member of the Hamas Political Bureau.
It was so close, and very few members of the, mainly of the military leadership, and maybe one or two from the political bureau, who were aware about the operation.
At dawn, Hamas fighters come into Israel by land, air, and sea. They begin their attack. Fighters break through the fence.
We've identified at least 10 points where they storm through, and they attack the large number of military bases that there are surrounding the Gaza Strip, and they completely overrun. And this is where they pay the price for this complacency, really. Many of the soldiers are caught in bed. You can see it in the videos. They haven't even had time to get armed and get their uniforms on. They're taken completely by surprise. And so what that means is that Hamas takes itself by surprise. And this is, mm-hmm. comes through very clearly, talking to Bassem Naim from the Hamas General Council.
Anyone who have watched this were surprised. I was totally surprised. How can this happen?
They were completely taken aback by the ease with which they went through the frontier.
But the fighters continue. From military bases to kibbutzim, residential settlements close to the fence, to a music festival with thousands of young people just 5 kilometers from Gaza.
Based on my information, they were not aware that there is a musical festival in the area.
The film homes in on a few specific moments captured from Hamas body cams. One of them comes from bomb shelters along the highway, next to where the music festival was taking place.
So when Hamas turned up, they had, you know, between these bomb shelters, about 100 people. It's quite clear the principal aim that day was to take hostages. What they do is they stand outside for some time, throwing hand grenades in and firing their machine guns, and then eventually sort of haul out dying or injured people and load them into trucks and take them off as hostages.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that, it's very disturbing to watch. You can hear the screams of the people in the bomb shelters. The other thing that has happened by this point is that from pretty early in the morning, word goes round that these breaches have been made and that the Israeli army has just disappeared. Hamas is followed through the fence by gunmen from a number of other organizations, Islamic Jihad and so on, but then also by waves and waves of civilians.
Yeah, it was like a jailbreak.
So things begin to change around the middle of the day. By then, the Israeli army is mobilized. The Israeli army would eventually release footage of some of its helicopter strikes. And pilots would go on to say that it was hard to tell the difference between Hamas fighters and civilians. Can you talk about that part of the documentary?
Yes, so the reporting in Israel is that at midday, the army issues a version of what is called the Hannibal Directive. The Hannibal Directive is something that first emerged in the 1980s. It was a protocol whereby the Israeli military decided it was better that soldiers be killed rather than allowing them to be captured. This is because in the past you've had these extraordinary prisoner exchanges of 1,000 Palestinians for one Israeli soldier. The reporting in the Israeli press, specifically the newspaper Yediot Aronot, is that Apache helicopter pilots in particular are told you can take the risk of hitting hostages.
There is a story of a kibbutz resident who came under fire from an Israeli helicopter.
That's right. So the Israeli military has not denied this story. Israel's Channel 12 interviewed a woman who was abducted on the morning of the 7th. She's with nine people. There, nine of them are sort of loaded onto a flatback, and they come under fire from a helicopter.
And as we are advancing about half a kilometer from the fence, the helicopter fires gunshots, shooting at us. And I'm sure that this is it. I will die now. I am done for. And then I raise my head and I am alive.
Now, one of the hostages is definitely killed, and the interviewee herself is quite badly injured. In fact, she later plays dead, which is why she doesn't end up as a hostage. So there is that direct account. I suspect it happened quite a few times, and we don't know about it because the people that happened to are dead. Mm. We've done a very careful analysis, and we reckon, in addition to that one person we know died, there are 27 people who are taken hostage, who never make it to the fence, and who die in circumstances that are unclear.
Okay, so Israel said it regained control of the south on October 9th. And in the aftermath, officials did a number of press conferences in front of homes that came under attack. And you really don't need to be a forensic expert to notice that the damage looks like it came from tanks. They're like huge holes in the side of a house, which Hamas really didn't have access to that sort of weaponry on October 7th. So what did you learn through this evidence about how Israeli ground troops were operating?
You're right. You can look at the damage. Places like Kibbutz Be'eri and Kfar Aza have suffered enormous damage, and it's clearly not damage which is caused by sidearms and RPG fire. Now, Hamas, in order to smoke people out of their safe rooms, was setting houses on fire. So quite often you see a house which is burned out. Now, that quite possibly was Hamas or other gunmen or other elements. But you also see a lot of houses which are clearly simply destroyed by heavy weaponry, and that's been done by the Israelis. One of the survivors that you hear from in the film is Yasmin Porat, who was at the music festival, fled to Kibbutz Be'eri, and ended up in this house in total, I think, with 15 other hostages in all. Now, she escapes because one of the gunmen decides to surrender and takes her out as a human shield. She describes she's standing next to the soldiers and she sees them bring a tank up and they're preparing to fire.
And they suddenly brought a tank. And I asked one of the soldiers, but if you shoot shells, won't they harm the hostages? And he tells me, no, we're only doing it on the sides to take down walls.
But it's clear that that tank is what kills a substantial number of the hostages inside that house.
They weren't killed because they were executed. They were killed by the shooting.
It seems there were 12 hostages, including two children, who were killed inside that house.
After the break, how media coverage of the day shaped the war we're seeing now. Okay, so in the days after October 7th, a lot of the media honed in on a few key stories, stories that really don't match up with your own death toll or Israel's, for that matter. You interviewed Yossi Landau from the volunteer organization Zaka, which was tasked with collecting the bodies from the kibbutzim. So I have three questions for you to help our listeners understand this. What is Zaka? Who is Yossi Landau? And why is it important to interview him for the film?
So Zaka is an organization of ultra-Orthodox volunteers who collect bodies and prepare them for Jewish burial in the wake of natural disasters and so on. Yossi Landau was the head of Zaka in the south of Israel. He's enormously important because a lot of the stories that emerge in the international media in the days after the 7th of October come from Zaka officials, and in particular from Yossi Landau. I mean, you know, respect to him for agreeing to be interviewed. Very few other people were prepared to be interviewed. We interviewed him because there were a number of stories that were clearly extremely problematic. And we confronted him with the problems with these stories, and viewers can judge for themselves whether he effectively deals with those problems. I mean, for example, he had said that there was one house in Berry where he'd come across two piles of 10 children in each of the piles, so 20 children who were all bound up, burned, and murdered.
Two piles of 10 children each were tied to the back, burned to death. It's indescribable, and I won't describe everything that I saw.
Now, for a start, the problem with that is there are only 10 children killed at Kibbutz Be'eri. Most of the children who die on the 7th of October die at Kibbutz Be'eri. But even so, there are only 10. There are not 20.
But still, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeated the claim in a conversation with U.S. President Joe Biden.
They took dozens of children, bound them up, burned them, and executed them.
Here's how he responded when Richard asked him for photos of what happened.
Not children, it's 18-year-old. So we're all together, when you look at them and they're burned, you don't know exactly the ages. So you're talking about 18-year-old, 20 years old, and you just don't look on the spot, identification to see the ages or something like that.
On interviewing Yossi Landau, it became quite clear that the house he was referring to is the one we've already been talking about, where the hostages were actually killed by Israeli forces. So he makes no mention of that. And we know who was in that house. There were two children in that house, 12-year-old twins. And there simply weren't two piles of 10 children bound up together. Another story he tells, again, Kibbutz Be'eri, encountering a pregnant woman whose stomach has been cut open, the baby has been pulled out, still attached to the umbilical cord, stabbed, and the woman murdered.
She was a pregnant woman. Her stomach was butchered open. The baby that was connected to the cord was stabbed, and she was shot in the back.
That was Yossi Landau speaking to the media in October. Here's how he responded when Richard asked him for photos of what happened.
This is the baby. This is it.
I'm sorry to be graphic here, but I can't see a baby here.
You can't see the baby but this is the picture of the mother. Okay. For sure, you know, we didn't think when we were over there, we didn't think to camera everything.
Now, the kibbutz itself has said this simply isn't true. There is no such victim at Be'eri.
We contacted the Israeli government, military, and Zaka, but none responded to our findings.
Now, Zaka itself then put out a statement saying, well, look, our volunteers are not trained forensically. They're not qualified to give these judgments, which obviously begs the question why they were giving these judgments and why the Western media was simply accepting these judgments.
Al Jazeera's investigative unit also investigated another claim that made its way across Western media.
The Israelis claim there was widespread and systematic sexual assault and rape, that this was used as a weapon of war by Hamas. What we have found is that when you really pick it apart, the evidence for this comes almost entirely from Israeli officials and first responders, who we know from the issues around babies being killed are unreliable. Now, if you take them out of the equation, what are we left with? We have two witnesses, basically, that they come back to again and again. There may be many reasons in these traumatic situations why people don't talk, why it takes them a long time to talk, and all of that has to be taken into account. But it's odd that there's only two witnesses. Second point, there's no forensic evidence. There's no forensic evidence at all. Now, this can, again, be to do with the chaos of the aftermath, the difficulty of collecting forensic evidence, the need to bury people quickly in accordance with Jewish ritual, and so on. Possibly. But again, the fact is there is no forensic evidence. You then have thousands of post-mortem photographs. None indicates rape or sexual violence. Now, some of it, it's been suggested some of it does, but there's really not a great deal you can read from a corpse. And again, Zaka says we weren't documenting in that way. But the fact is there are thousands of photographs of the aftermath. And the fact that nothing shows this, I think, raises suspicions. Now, to be clear here, I'm not suggesting there were no rapes, but the idea that it was widespread and systematic, there is simply no evidence to support this.
And why is that an important distinction, widespread and systematic?
Well, I think the idea of widespread and systematic is that Hamas were deliberately using it as a weapon of war. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think if it did happen, it was isolated instances where discipline broke down. Also, why widespread and systematic would indicate that it was far, far, you know, wider, far more prevalent than was the case if it's a few isolated instances.
That's something lawyer Madeleine Rees, the Secretary General for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, mentions in the film as well.
In every conflict, whenever there are men with guns intent on perpetrating violence, it is highly unlikely there will not be sexual violence. But nothing that I've seen put forward so far suggests that it was widespread and systematic. It's a very high bar to actually reach.
Earlier this year, a team of UN experts went to Israel to investigate and found, quote, reasonable grounds to believe that rape had occurred during the attack on October 7th.
If you actually read it, though, it's clear that conscientious professionals worked on it. Again, it is relying almost entirely on the testimonies of Israeli officials and first responders. It states very clearly there is no photographic or video evidence at all. It states very clearly that there are very few witnesses. So you actually look at the detail of that report, and for me anyway, it certainly doesn't contradict the sort of conclusions we were coming to.
What have you heard from the Israeli government about your findings?
Nothing at all. They don't want to talk to us.
One thing that some of the viewers might find surprising is that you interviewed someone from Hamas. Do you think that that will be controversial?
Well, it may be controversial, but it's absurd not to. As I say, we're absolutely frank and clear in the film about the crimes that Hamas committed on October the 7th. But if your view of Hamas and your analysis of Hamas begins and ends with they are monsters who do monstrous things because they are monsters, you're obviously not getting very far in understanding things. Hamas is ultimately a rational actor, and whatever you think of their actions, they do things for a reason. And if you're actually going to try and understand what happens on October the 7th, clearly you have to try and understand why Hamas was doing it. Hamas is defensive. Hamas, I think, is in denial about the scale of the killing of civilians that went on. But if you actually listen carefully to what they're saying, there is an acknowledgement that it didn't quite go as they'd planned. They will talk about the degree to which they were taken by surprise, by the collapse of the Israeli military. And I think they have a sense that there was an element of anarchy that then prevailed, in which things occurred that certainly shouldn't have. They'll also point out to you the number of civilians who poured through the border. Mm. Now, you know, whether that's a justification or an excuse or not is another matter. I mean, one remarkable thing in the film, the Hamas man we talked to and others talk about the March of Return, the Great March of Return in 2018-19. Of course, that was not a protest that was straightforwardly organized by Hamas. But for those who are not familiar with it, essentially the peaceful demonstrations were organized along the fence. And the Israeli response was for snipers to line up along the sand berms and simply to shoot people. I mean, hundreds of people were killed. This was peaceful demonstration. I think that there was a single day in early 2018 where more than 60 people were killed. And it brought it home very clearly that peaceful protest simply wasn't going to work. It was simply going to be ignored. And Bassem Naim in the film, the Hamas leader, says,
during the Great March of Return, we went peacefully in thousands. But what was the response of the international community? Nothing. Keeping the ears and eyes always closed. Within this context, we have discussed in many times, in many sessions, what can we do? Generally, there was a consensus in the political bureau. We have to move. We have to take action. If we don't do it, Palestine will be forgotten totally and deleted from the international map.
And this is what they did.
So I've noticed that Israel's most strident defenders, you know, those who are still justifying the ongoing assault on Gaza, tend to argue almost as if the conflict began and ended on October 7th, that this was an unprovoked, unjustified attack on Israel's civilian population, that it was so barbaric, they have no choice but to essentially flatten Gaza. And I guess that's why a film like this is so important, because it addresses that frame of argument head on. This is why the details of what happened on October 7th matter, because what's happening in Gaza today are a direct result of both what happened on that day and what didn't happen, but people think happened that day.
That's right. I mean, to contextualize the events of October the 7th is not to justify them, but clearly you have to understand the background to them. And then the alleged atrocities that happen are then used to justify a response which is massively disproportionate. I mean, the Palestinians are used to disproportionate response, but this is massively disproportionate.
As we record this, at least 32,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been confirmed killed, and the number is likely to be much higher.
The health services have broken down. They can't really count them. Many, many bodies are under the rubble. The war is still ongoing. I mean, by the end of this, it's quite possible that the true figure for dead and injured will not be far off 10% of the population of the Gaza Strip. Hamas did this because they wanted to reinsert the Palestinian people into the political equation of the Middle East. And they succeeded. As they say in our film, they have established the principle that you cannot simply ignore the Palestinian people. But it has come at a colossal cost and the effective destruction of the Gaza Strip. And it's very difficult to see how we move forward from here.
You have been listening to Al Jazeera Podcast, reporting on its findings concerning the veracity of Israel's reports on Hamas's October 7th assault on Israel. And now on to our next feature, an article written by Samer Jaber and published by Al Jazeera News Service. Samer Jaber is a PhD researcher specializing in political economy at Royal Holloway University of London. He is also a fellow with the Council for At-Risk Academics, and he focuses on the Arab world and the Middle East region. Samer is also remembered as serving as co-host on This Week in Palestine, while he was completing his PhD at Brandeis University. I will read Professor Jaber's timely article titled "The U.S. Plan to Revamp the Palestinian Authority is Doomed to Fail." For 2 months now, the United States and other Western countries backing Israel have been talking about the day after in Gaza. They have rejected Israeli assertions that the Israeli army will remain in control of the Strip and pointed to the Palestinian Authority, the PA, as their preferred political actor to take over governments once the war is over. In so doing, the United States and its allies have paid little regard to what the Palestinian people want. The current leadership of the PA lost the last democratic elections held in the occupied Palestinian territory in 2006 to Hamas, and since then it has steadily lost popularity. In a recent public opinion poll, by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, some 90% of residents were in favor of the resignation of the PA President Mahmoud Abbas, and 60% called for the dismantling of the PA itself. Washington is undoubtedly aware of the low public interest in the PA, but there is a reason why it insists on supporting its takeover of Gaza. Its leadership has been a reliable partner for decades in maintaining a status quo in the interests of Israel. The U.S. would like that arrangement to continue, so its backing for the PA may be accompanied by an attempt to revamp it in order to solve its legitimacy problem. But even if this effort succeeds, it is unlikely the new iteration of the PA would be sustainable. Perhaps one of the main factors that has convinced the United States that the PA is a good choice for post-war governance in Gaza is its Perhaps one of the main factors that has convinced the U.S. that the PA is a good choice for post-war governance in Gaza is its anti-Hamas stance and willingness to conduct security coordination with Israel. Since the commencement of the conflict between Israel and Gaza on October 7th, the PA and its leadership have not issued an official statement offering explicit political support for the Palestinian resistance. Their rhetoric has predominantly focused on condemning and disapproving of attacks on civilians on both sides, while also rejecting the expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland. In a political address on the ninth day of the war, Abbas criticized Hamas, asserting that their actions did not represent the Palestinian people. He emphasized that the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, is the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people and underscored the importance of peaceful resistance as the only legitimate means to oppose Israeli occupation. This statement was later retracted by his office. In December, Hussein al-Sheikh, a PA official and Secretary General of the Executive Committee of the PLO, also criticized Hamas in an interview with Reuters. He suggested its armed resistance, method, and approach has failed and led to many casualties among the civilian population. The stance of the PA is consistent with its narrow political and economic interests, which have come at the expense of the Palestinian national cause. It has systematically and brutally stamped out any opposition and any support of other factions, including Hamas. In order to maintain its rule over West Bank cities, while Israel continues with its brutal occupation and dispossession of the Palestinian people. In Israel's war on Gaza in 2008 to 2009, the PA leadership hoped to regain administrative control of Gaza with assistance from Israel. During that conflict, the PA prohibited any activities in the West Bank in support of Gaza and threatened to arrest participants. I myself faced harassment and the threat of arrest for attempting to join a demonstration against the war. Similar positions were adopted by the PA, albeit with less aggressive measures, in subsequent Israeli assaults on Gaza, as its leadership came to recognize that Hamas was unlikely to relinquish its control over the Strip. U.S. politics, Canada's multiculturalism, South America's geopolitical rise. Since October 7th, the PA has taken a bolder stance, marked by more aggressive actions. Its security forces have suppressed demonstrations and marches held in support of Gaza, resorting to shooting live ammunition at participants. Additionally, the PA has recently detained individuals expressing support for the Palestinian resistance. While cracking down on Palestinian protests, the PA has done nothing to protect its people from attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinian communities, which have resulted in deaths, injuries, and the displacement of hundreds of people in the occupied West Bank. Additionally, the Israeli army has intensified its raids on the PA-administered areas, leading to the arrest of thousands of the killing, leading to the arrest of thousands and the killing of hundreds of Palestinians, with no reaction from the PA. The Palestinian Authority's inability to offer basic protection has added to the deterioration of its legitimacy among the Palestinians. Furthermore, by taking a stance against the Palestinian resistance and aligning itself with Israel and the United States, the PA is only further undermining its own legitimacy. Washington is aware of the growing unpopularity of the PA and its leadership among Palestinians, but it is not giving up because it seems to believe that that can be fixed. That is, because the U.S. has tried to revamp the authority before, as it has always faced problems with the legitimacy due to the way it was set up. As a governing institution, the Palestinian Authority was established to bring an end to the First Intifada. Conceived under the interim peace agreements in Oslo, it was envisioned as an administrative body to oversee civil affairs for Palestinians in the occupied Gaza Strip and certain parts of the West Bank, excluding occupied East Jerusalem. It effectively took on the role as an Israeli security contractor in exchange for certain benefits relating to administering Palestinian population centers. The PA faithfully fulfilled its mandate, carrying out routine arrests and surveillance of Palestinian individuals, whether they were involved in actions against Israel or were activists opposing its corrupt policies. Thus, Israel strategically benefited from the establishment of the PA, but the same cannot be said for the Palestinian people, as they continued to experience the ravages of a military occupation. Despite this, the PA under Yasser Arafat, or what they call PA 1.0, leveraged patronage and corruption to maintain some level of support. Notably, Arafat viewed the Oslo process as an interim measure, expecting a full independent Palestinian state by 2000. He pragmatically engaged in security collaboration with Israel, hoping to build trust and ultimately achieve peaceful coexistence. In 1996, responding to an ongoing Palestinian resistance, he even declared a war on terror and convened a security summit at Sharm el-Sheikh involving Israel, Egypt, and the United States. In 2000, the civil and security arrangements overseen by the PA became increasingly fragile and eventually collapsed, triggering the eruption of the Second Intifada. This uprising was a response to Israel's policies of settlement expansion, its firm refusal to accept any form of Palestinian sovereignty between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, and broader social and economic grievances. In 2002, the British administration conceived the idea of refurbishing the PA as part of the roadmap for peace. While Arafat's leadership was perceived as a hindering factor, he had already collaborated with the United States by implementing structural reforms, including the creation of a prime minister's position. Seeking to reshape the Palestinian leadership, the U.S. engaged with potential alternative leaders, including Mahmoud Abbas, who eventually assumed the presidency of the PA in 2005 after the suspicious death of Arafat. The PA took its first blow when Hamas won the elections in 2006 and was able to form a government. The U.S. and European Union rejected the results, boycotted the and suspended financial assistance to the PA, while Israel halted the transfer of tax revenues. Meanwhile, the PA security apparatus leadership refused to deal with the Hamas government and continued their work as usual, claiming they reported to the PA president's office. For several months, Hamas struggled to maintain its PA government, while Abbas and his supporters made the significant efforts to isolate it. In 2007, Hamas took over the Palestinian Authority security apparatus in the Gaza Strip and assumed full control of all PA institutions. Abbas declared Hamas an unwanted entity in the West Bank and ordered the expulsion of the Hamas government and the imprisonment of many of Hamas's operatives. After splitting the PA into two entities, one in the Gaza Strip and the other in the West Bank, Abbas, along with allies Mohammed Dahlan and Salam Fayyad, led efforts to restructure the PA in the West Bank with full support from the United States and the European Union. Under what we call PA 2.0, two major restructuring efforts took place. First, it consolidated the Palestinian security apparatus under a united command, led by U.S. Army General Keith Dayton. The revamping of the Palestinian security forces aimed at deepening their partnership with the Israeli state and army. Additionally, it sought to cultivate a vast interest among PA personnel in maintaining the role of the PA. Second, the restructuring of the PA consolidated its budget, placing all its resources under the Ministry of Finance. This restructuring did not result in a better PA. It remained a dysfunctional entity which mismanaged resources and service provision, leading to a severe deterioration in living standards for the majority of Palestinians. Its leadership enjoyed certain privileges due to its security coordination with Israel and engaged in widespread corruption practices that have raised concern even among Palestinian Authority supporters. Meanwhile, Israel's settlement in enterprises continued expanding without limits, and the violence employed by the Israeli army and the settlers against the ordinary Palestinians only worsened. The lack of support for the Palestinian Authority leadership and its dysfunction have raised concerns about whether it can play a role in the upcoming post-Gaza war arrangements that the United States administration is trying to put together. That is why Washington has signaled it will seek to revamp the PA once again into PA 3.0, with the aim of addressing the needs of various parties. The U.S. administration and its allies seek an authority that can provide security to Israel and engage in a peaceful process without altering the status quo. Since the start of the war, several U.S. envoys have visited Ramallah, carrying out the same message, that the PA needs to be revamped. In December, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Abbas and al-Sheikh, the PLO Secretary General, urging them to bring new blood into the government. Al-Sheikh is considered a possible successor to Abbas, who could be part of these efforts to restructure the PA. However, after more than 100 days since the start of the Israeli war on Gaza, it looks like Washington does not have a concrete plan and only has some general ideas which the PA has declared a readiness to discuss. More importantly, the U.S. vision does not seem to take into account the will of the Palestinian people. The Palestinian public clearly demands a leadership that can lead a democratic national unity. The Palestinian public clearly demands a leadership that can head a democratic national entity capable of fulfilling the Palestinian national aspirations, including creating an independent state and realizing the Palestinians' right of return to their homelands. Revamping the PA implies intensifying cooperation with Israel and providing Israeli settlers with more security, which effectively means more insecurity and disposition for the Palestinians. As a result, the Palestinian people will continue to perceive the PA as illegitimate, and public anger, upheaval, and resistance will continue to grow. In this sense, the U.S. vision for revamping the PA would fail because it would not address the core issues of Israeli occupation and apartheid, which successive American administrations have systematically and purposely ignored. That was a critical article written by Samer Jaber, a Palestinian political activist and political researcher and writer, published by Al Jazeera News Service. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on KKRN.org, where you can stream us live every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will be with us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.